As if the 1973 movie The Exorcist wasn't scary enough, it also happens to be based on a real story. And I'll put the word real in quotes here because there's a demon in the story. And whether it was real or not, something was going on in 1949 to a young man known as Robbie Manheim. Here's the film historian Andrew Nelson.
As the story goes, Robbie is a withdrawn child, kind of a loner, disturbed by many accounts, who also relies upon his family members to be his friends. And he's particularly close to one aunt, who then dies when he's 14 years old. And shortly after the aunt's passing, disquieting phenomena begin to occur in the family home. Things levitating or furniture moving. And a lot of this seems to be localized around Robbie. So they consult their local men of faith who are Lutheran, and they ultimately recommend that what they really need is an exorcism, which means bringing in a Catholic priest. A few different versions of the story. One has a visiting Catholic priest come and perform an exorcism at Georgetown University Hospital. This exorcism does not go according to plan. The boy at one point gets loose of his restraints and grabs some kind of sharp implement and begins stabbing people so they have to stop the exorcism. And then, supposedly, there's a second one, which takes place also in a hospital, but this time in St. Louis, where the exorcism is successful. It's an enticing story. It's the type of story that tells you those things that happened in the distant past in Europe, the types of possession stories we hear from medieval France, for example, could happen here in America. And the story comes to the attention about a year later, 1950, of a young man named William Peter Blatty. And 18 years later, he writes a novel inspired by this case of local demonic possession and attempts by local scientists as well as Catholic authorities to exorcise the demon. And that book, released in 1969, is The Exorcist. That book becomes a genuine cultural phenomenon. Runaway bestseller. Spends 55 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and 13 million copies are sold. And that's before the film is inevitably adapted for the screen in 1973's The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin. So from, you know, that kind of local lore of the devil in the heartland, so to speak, to one of the most popular films not only of the 70s but of all time, we've got this strange fascination with, say, the place of the devil in modern American society.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about The Exorcist today, the movie, the original. There have been sequels. There's a new one out just this month, which is not getting great reviews. But even if it were, there's no way it would have the power of the first one, which outraged and captivated audiences when it came out in 1973. And so, you know, this whole conversation is a spoiler, or most of it anyway. If you need a refresher, The Exorcist is about the demonic possession of a 12-year-old girl who's on the cusp of womanhood, and her mother and the local Catholic priest have both lost their faith. The Salt Lake Film Society is screening The Exorcist this month. We'll give you some details here in a moment. Andrew Nelson is going to be with us through the hour. He's chair of the film department at the University of Utah. And he told us, yes, The Exorcist is a unique bit of filmmaking, but it's also kind of typical for its time.
So we today remember the sort of late 1960s to early 1970s as an exciting time in Hollywood history when The major studios made gestures to more radical forces within American society. So we get films like The Graduate or Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider. So we call this the Hollywood Renaissance or sometimes the New Hollywood. You know, much celebrated, a lot of nostalgia for this moment.
But new generation of directors.
Well, exactly. Yeah, younger filmmakers, right. More socially conscious films. But that quickly dies out by the early 1970s. And what reasserts itself in Hollywood is something of a tried and true formula. That is making films with broad appeal based on pre-existing, what we would today call properties, but at the time meant novels.
Yeah.
So if you look at some of the biggest hits of the late 60s and the early 70s, they're all based on hugely popular novels. Love Story, Airport, The Godfather, Jaws, for example. And into that comes The Exorcist. So Hollywood was looking for these sort of cultural phenomena that they could adapt to the screen. It just makes financial sense. The other way that the film is typical too is it represents what we might call a kind of mainstreaming of exploitation fare, a kind of exploitation blockbuster. So whereas genres like horror or science fiction had once been, you know, somewhat marginalized in Hollywood production, you know, films for teenagers, for example, right? Now, those types of films about aliens or heroes from space or demons from the underworld are suddenly mainstream entertainments.
They're getting the budgets.
Exactly. They're getting the blockbuster treatment. So that is, of course, Jaws. That is, of course, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's Star Wars. That's Superman. This is what gets us to the sort of science fiction and superhero films of the late 70s and 80s. But The Exorcist is also a part of this. It's the type of story that, you know, could have 20 years before made for a great B-level Hollywood production, a kind of possession film. But by the end of the 1960s, we see in films like Rosemary's Baby an appetite for more intellectual and more mainstream approaches to this formerly niche subject matter.
I think the other thing that you talk about in this context, what's changing or what's different, is that the monster is evolving, like the nature of the monster. The monster in horror films is changing and relocating from the continent, right, to this continent.
Yeah. From without to within.
Yeah.
So, so horror films are always about some kind of existential threat to our way of life. But for the first maybe half decade of the horror movie's existence, those threats came from without. They were monsters from Europe who either coming to the United States, you know, to steal our women, or they took place in ancient times in the old country. And then in the 1950s, we see a kind of shift in the horror film where it takes on a more science fictional component, but it's still invaders from space, for example. But in the 1960s, we begin to see a shift in horror where the threat is not from the past. It's not otherworldly. It's not from another country. The threat is American. Mm-hmm. That the threat is emerging from within the very institutions that we formerly relied upon to protect us from evil. So that we see evil emerging from schools, from churches, and especially from within families. So Psycho is an important film in this respect, which takes, you know, the boy next door character and archetype and turns him into a disturbed serial killer. And that's a trend we see continuing over the course of the 1960s, and that certainly is also how Exorcist is in some ways typical of filmmaking of its time. It's suggesting that evil is going to come from close to us, and that is particularly scary. And maybe that connects with some conversations we were having in the culture at that time.
I want to ask about that because there is that question, and it seems like the most obvious question that I would ask a film scholar, like, what's happening in the culture at the time?
Yeah.
But I wanted to read this comment by Friedkin, which I think is so great because it really challenges how much of his film or any film is actually about the social impact of the cultural moment. This is what Friedkin said. This was in 1991. And he says this to the critic Mark Kermode. He says, "I don't think the mood of the times had anything whatsoever to do with the success of The Exorcist. In fact, I'm not aware of any far-reaching social problems that The Exorcist dealt with. And this is what he said. He said, that usually comes later when people run out of things to say about the film. They start describing the social implications of it.
Yeah.
So what do you make of that? Him saying, now, is he just how can you tease apart the fact that a film happens in a social context?
Yeah.
Is he just being, you know, moody?
Well, you know, Friedkin, and anyone who's seen him interviewed will know, is a really interesting and charismatic guy. But he is also one who's likely to challenge the prevailing wisdom.
Sure.
So there could be a part of that. I mean, he's also, even though he's working in the 70s, he's got something of an old school Hollywood bent to him, where the answer to the question was – to the question of what does this film have to do with the issues of the day was nothing. This is just a movie.
Yeah. Like John Ford would say.
Exactly. Yeah. John Ford being the kind of the archetypal example of that. But, you know, there are many other filmmakers who took a similar line. So it could be part of that. Now, can we ever separate how films are received in the moment from the broader culture? Probably not.
Yeah.
But Friedkin is onto something in that it's going to be, you know, much more complex and less, let's say, determinative than we might expect. That, oh, this was happening in the culture and therefore – everybody was interested in The Exorcist. Now, that hasn't stopped people from making those types of arguments.
Yeah.
And they have pointed, as always happens with horror films, to things that were happening in the culture that might explain interest in the film. But to Friedkin's point, I think the film is not, especially in its 1973 version, at all explicit about its politics, what it's commenting on. In fact, it gestures more towards a kind of archetypal struggle between good and evil that manifests itself across time.
Mm.
And this just happens to be one instance of this battle taking place. Now, that's not to say we couldn't indulge some speculation about why this film might have appealed to people in 1973.
Yeah.
Though this argument usually invokes a fundamental change that took place in American culture with respect to the rearing of children, let's say, how you raise your children. And this movement was exemplified by a physician named Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Mm-hmm.
And what Dr. Spock, who wrote a best-selling book that had been reprinted many times since, and when I teach The Exorcist in my continuing education classes, and I've got folks who are in their 60s or 70s in the class.
They know Dr. Spock.
As soon as I say Dr. Spock, their eyes light up, they tell me they had that book, and suddenly they start making connections between parenting in the 1970s and The Exorcist.
Wow.
So there has to be something to this. I mean, so in general, you know, Dr. Spock advocated being more flexible with your children, being more affectionate with them, right? That you couldn't really overpraise your children, that the tough love approach didn't really work. It actually raised, you know, repressed, broken adults. And, you know, there's no question there's something to that.
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly, some people saw that as an overcorrection, that it led to a culture of permissiveness where people expected instant gratification. Mm-hmm. So in the context of The Exorcist, we have, you know, a divorced single mother, you know, astronomically increasing divorce rates being a feature of post-war American society, particularly in the 60s and 70s. We have, you know, a child who, is clearly being raised in a certain way. She's allowed to do a lot of things. She's allowed to stay up late at parties, right? Her mother is maybe a little bit neglectful, but, you know, is a busy, you know, working mom in a certain case. Doesn't seem to have a lot of, you know, other positive adult influences in her life. In fact, seems to have some negative ones, some ones that might make us a little bit uncomfortable, and we see that in the movie.
Her mother's not religious?
No, absolutely not. She's kind of, you know, has abandoned traditional notions of morality.
Yep.
So that is there in the movie. The question then would be, does that explain what happens to the characters?
Mm-hmm.
Is that justification for the evil visited upon them? And I don't think it is.
Andrew Nelson, he's chair of the Film and Media Arts Department at the University of Utah. We're going to be screening The Exorcist on October 21st at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. to back up a second and ask about this prologue in the film.
Sure.
In northern Iraq.
Yes.
Connect this moment. What's Friedkin going here? There's some clearly some foreshadowing here. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily connected directly to the narrative itself. We have Father Mirren who is seeing these images, you know, the face of an old woman. We see this demon statue, this blind eye of a worker,
yes.
Right? That will seem familiar as we see them later. But what do you see there in terms of its technique?
Yeah. So that comes from the novel. And you know, Blatty, Father Mirren character, was inspired in part by a couple of real-life Catholic figures who were also archaeologists.
Yeah.
So there's a big tradition in the Catholic Church of archaeological digs in the Holy Land, trying to recover relics, learn more about history, and so on. So Mirren is a Catholic priest in that mode,
right,
of the kind of archaeologist priest looking into Christianity's history, hopefully for answers that will be relevant to the present and our ongoing struggle against the forces of evil. So we have this lengthy prologue set in Iraq that gives us all of that kind of iconography and ends with a kind of confrontation of sorts between Mirren and the statue, a demonic figure. And so what it establishes, the idea that this is a battle that's been going on for a long time, that there is an ancient evil, that it's still with us in the world, that we still see marks of it that endure to the present time. So this idea of not only sort of statues, but the idea that the body can be physically marked by evil in some way, that becomes very important later in the movie.
Does it work?
I think so.
Yeah.
What I like about the film is it doesn't make clear if the demon Father Mirren later encounters, having possessed Reagan, is this the same demon?
Yeah, is it followed him or whatever?
Right. What is the nature of evil? I mean, those questions are left open, which I think is to the film's benefit. But it clearly establishes that there is this ancient evil that these sorts of men of faith are going to confront repeatedly, not only in their own lives, but maybe for time immemorial.
Well, while we're on that, talk about the role of the demon, the role of quote-unquote Satan.
Yeah.
Because I think that – like what is – how would you characterize the thinking about – Satan in the early 1970s, for example, when the book comes out and then eventually the film, because the question is this some ancient monster figure or is it the devil of the Bible or whatever?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, the film suggests that it's some kind of demon, but isn't the film itself is not particularly clear about what that means.
Yeah.
And what force exactly is possessing Reagan? Now, there's lots we could say about, the 1970s and the devil.
Yeah.
We understand that –
there's a kind of a cultural obsession about the
it
devil.
It is.
Yeah.
And manifests itself in what's sometimes referred to as satanic panic.
Yeah.
There are some very sad in retrospect stories of – pseudoscientists claiming to be able to recover repressed memories in children and the children recalling horrendous sexual abuse, usually at the hands of their relatives, and also involvement in satanic rituals, for example. So that is, in the air at this particular moment where the decline of religion, which, in mainstream society is kind of celebrated in a certain way as a kind of emancipation. Here we have, once again, a moment in human history where reason is reasserting itself. Well, we get among the religious a certain kind of backlash to this, and we see this in many ways. This would be potentially the silent majority that brings Nixon into office. But it might also be a kind of anxiety, or at least a manifestation of an anxiety, that even though we recognize we're not religious anymore and that's a good thing, but maybe we've given something up.
Yeah.
Maybe there is evil out there. And because we've given up these old ways of knowing, these old beliefs, we're going to be more vulnerable to it than at any point in our history.
So let's talk about what you think the film is about. So you've said, and I'll spoil it here. I know what you've said, which is in some ways you see in here a mother's journey, which we can talk about. But let's talk about the part where you think that this is about a loss of faith as well.
Yeah. I watched the film and I struggled to see it as anything but a film that's in favor of faith, a film that is an endorsement of faith, that there is something beyond human understanding, that religion is, if imperfect, at least gets us close to that. And so we need to avail ourselves of religion in these, you know, trying times, let's say, when we've made ourselves vulnerable. That, to me, seems to be what the film is about. Mm. You know, certainly Blatty envisioned his novel as being, you know, what we might call pro-Catholic.
Yeah.
Not everyone saw it that way.
Sure.
It was certainly a divisive book and especially divisive film when it came to religious leaders.
Billy Graham didn't see it that way.
He certainly did not. His you know, infamous quote is something to the effect of, "The devil is in every frame of that film," which I suppose is true in a way, but that was the intention.
Technically true, right?
The devil is supposed to be you know, in the film. So I, you know, I have difficulty seeing it as anything other than what we might actually call a kind of conservative film, right? And I say that, and listeners are probably going to, I don't know, you know, get their dander off and say, well, no, I didn't see it that way. But a lot of horror films are actually quite socially conservative in many ways.
Huh.
They involve the reestablishment of, you know, traditional values or notions of morality. You know, they suggest that certain man-made institutions are going to fail us, especially science. Science repeatedly fails the characters in horror films, and they need to resort back to more either religious or kind of fundamentally American characteristics to succeed. This is another way that The Exorcist is actually quite typical. But what's interesting about The Exorcist, and this is maybe the one thing that distinguishes it from all those typical features I said earlier, is that it is a horror film that was seen by so many people.
So we've talked a little bit about the mother and Regan. We'll come back to that in a moment.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about one of these threads in this film, of course, about a loss of faith. And that brings us to Father Damien Karas.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about where Karas is and how his idea of guilt over his mother, his sense of being disconnected from the purity of his faith. What's going on with Father Karas?
Yeah. He's an interesting figure in that he is both a priest and a scientist.
Yes. Yeah.
And because he does both those things, he occupies a unique place as a kind of counselor within the Catholic diocese in Washington, D.C. So he's, you know, kind of a man who has a foot in two different worlds. Mm. And then that relates to the crisis of faith that he's undergoing, that he feels guilt over the death of his mother, that he is asking questions, I think questions that every faithful person asks at some point about whether they've made a terrible mistake. Mm-hmm. But what the film does so well is it ties that crisis of faith to this, you know, positioning of him as both scientist and priest.
I want to shift to the little girl.
Yeah, Regan.
Regan. She finds a Ouija board. She starts to play with it.
Yep.
She's contacting an imaginary friend, Captain Howdy.
Yep.
and it's kind of creepy, but of course then she's innocent. She's a little rebellious. Her mother is kind of distant because she's busy and all of those sorts of – so it's really interesting to me. And then – one of the things you've talked about is there's this long history in cinema of evil children in movies. But she's not really an evil child in some way. What's going on here, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, so the notion of innocence corrupted
is
of course fundamentally frightening, but also there's a kind of fascination that we have with it. And that's that attraction and repulsion that's probably at the heart of a lot of horror films. So there is this tradition of evil children, oftentimes children who are, you know, possessed by some other force,
right.
You know, through some means. So, you know, Village of the Damned would be a great example. But there are, you know, there are others, and there are certainly
Children of the Corn.
Children of the Corn would be a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, you know, subsequently, I mean, right up through, you know, Hereditary would be a recent example of this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The evil child is still with us, or the idea that, you know, children are going to be preyed upon by evil because of their innocence, that they don't have the defense mechanisms that an adult does. And so they're particularly vulnerable.
They're vessels, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. So particularly attractive to the demonic force, but also particularly vulnerable, especially in the case of a film like The Exorcist, where the mother is, you know, not a bad mother by any stretch of the imagination,
no,
but is maybe typical in that she recognizes her daughter is on the brink of womanhood, is going through those changes, and so is trying to afford her a measure of independence. But that, of course, brings up one of the other kind of another seminal horror plot, that is the sexual maturation, yeah, of a young girl bringing, yeah, out monstrous abilities. It's not hard to think about what kind of anxieties that yeah, might speak to, you know, in that particular moment. But, you know, that's Carrie. That's a number of other films where young girls, you know, it's a film like The Craft where, you know, young girls become witches. That anxiety is bound up with that as well. So all of that is in The Exorcist.
Yeah.
But part of it, to what you said too, is you can imagine the audience member, especially in the 70s, you know, seeing what Reagan is doing, and who among us as children didn't break out the Ouija board
right,
at one point in time. I mean, the film, you know, trades in very conventional horror tropes, especially in its first beginning. You know, the,
yeah,
Ouija board,
yeah,
strange sounds in the attic,
yep,
you know, the characters finding a reason not to leave the house. I mean, the film is very conventional in that sense. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because,
right,
you know, if we've been using these moves for a long time, it's probably because they work. And Friedkin is able to use them especially effectively.
Let's talk about what might be the differing visions between a filmmaker and a novelist.
Sure.
Blatty and Friedkin here. The critic Mark Kermode describes The Exorcist as a movie at war with itself.
Yes.
There's one moment I want to ask you about in relation to this. So Blatty includes in his writing this lengthy exchange between Father Marin, the Max von Sydow character, and Father Karras.
Yep.
And they're discussing the nature of Reagan's possession. And they're outside of the room where all this horror is playing out. And they're staring inside, and Karras asks, what is going on in there? What is it? And he asks if it's the devil. If it's the devil, why this girl? She's so innocent. It makes no sense, he says. And then Marin delivers this explanation. At least this is Blatty as he's writing it out,
yes,
which is that – let me get this quote right. He said, the point is to make us the demon, the dark forces, is to make us despair, to see ourselves as animal and ugly, to reject our own humanity, and to reject the possibility that God could ever love us.
Yes. Yeah.
That's Blatty's idea. And
yes,
he sees this as key to this story. Friedkin hates it.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about this idea. I mean, it's basic theodicy, right? Why would God let anything happen to an innocent person?
Yeah. How could a loving God let us suffer so much?
Yes. So talk me through that.
Yeah. This is a really interesting moment. And it's doubly fascinating because this moment doesn't just exist in the script. It was filmed.
Yeah.
And then there are quite famously now two different versions of The Exorcist. There's the release version, which does not include that exchange,
yeah,
among a number of other things. And then there is a version from the early 2000s that was initially marketed as the version you've never seen before, where Friedkin reinserts this scene that Blatty had always advocated for.
Yeah.
So we actually get to see the film both ways. This is a very interesting moment. Now, clearly the collaboration between Blatty and Friedkin was a productive one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Blatty, of course, is going into the production with a lot more agency than the average novelist might. The book was so popular that the film was initially marketed as William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist.
Wow.
And then he also wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
And he's there on the set oftentimes. So he is, you know, there in a way that a writer is not often present on a set. But this doesn't seem to be to the film's detriment. I mean, Friedkin talks about having developed a really good working relationship. Now, this moment, though, was a key point of contention. Now, as Friedkin saw it, the moment, which is a literary moment,
yeah,
it's all about dialogue. And it's not even so much about the performance. It really is about the words that the characters say, right? So a very literary moment. Friedkin saw it as unnecessary because he felt that everything that Marin was saying in that moment, all of the questions that Karas was asking, were just inherent in the film.
Yeah.
They were simply there.
And I'm a director, show, don't tell.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And so that's the reason why he cut it out. And he felt very bad about it, though, not because he thought he made the wrong decision, but because he really respected Blatty. And they kind of had a falling out that lasted for a long time.
Yeah.
And so when the time came to do a new version of the film and they were able to recover some of this footage, he basically put it back in deference to his friend. But it not to oversimplify it, it does come down to that. You know, to what degree do we need to be explicit about what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do we need the characters to say explicitly what's happening, or can we trust the audience to intuit that from what we've shown them? Now, Blatty's sensibility, as I said, very literary, where we need to use words to communicate what we mean, and the other is a kind of a fundamentally cinematic ethos that we don't need words. What film gives us is something other than words.
Yeah.
We can show, not tell, as he said.
Well, what cinema gives us is also effects. And
yeah.
Let's talk about the special effects. What do you know about the effort that went into this? I mean, Friedkin apparently really wanted this to – I mean, there wasn't CGI in those days. But he did want this to be mechanically produced on set. And you've got projectile vomiting. You've got what looks like 29 degrees in there because, it's freezing and this thing. People are she's levitating.
Yep, contortions of her body
in
completely unnatural ways. No, I mean the film does a remarkable job with its practical effects. And, I've watched this film with audiences many times and they – the ones that are in the original film, they hold up. And part of that is down to Blatty's insistence that they be done on set – they be done in the moment so that characters are responding in real time. Mm. But they also, are just professional effects. You know, this is, again, that taking that exploitation mode of filmmaking but adding millions and millions of dollars behind it, and this is what you get. Now, famously, there are some scenes that they just couldn't pull off because of the effects. So there's a famous sequence that is in the revised version called the spider walk sequence Reagan, gets out of the room and contorts herself over backwards. And in the 1973, you needed wires to help the performer get down the stairs. There was no way to get rid of the wires. You can very easily get rid of the wires. So that type of scene was, for better or worse, reinserted into the later version of the film. So it suggests there was at the time an even greater ambition, but at least a recognition that there was a limit to what they could get away with.
Yeah.
That at a certain point, too much spectacle would compromise what Friedkin was trying to achieve. And I think in the original, he maintained that delicate balance expertly.
How delicate a balance when we're talking about the effects here? Because this is something I wanted to ask you about, and that is the extraordinarily visceral and graphic nature of some of these images and whether or not they were unprecedented for their time. I mean, it's one thing to see a young girl urinating on the floor, puking on and humiliating, the neighborhood priest, being incredibly profane. And we'll get to this other thing in a minute, using religious symbols to,
basically desecrate her own body.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well put. What do you want to say about that? Was this particularly graphic and shocking for its time?
Yeah. So as is always the case in horror films and films in general, there are a number of precedents that I could point to. There are many incredibly bloody, gory, violent horror films, independent horror films in the 1960s. So there are precedents. But those precedents were produced and consumed within what we might call niche contexts. Hmm. These were what sometimes are called grindhouse films or independent films. Right? They were not shown in mainstream cinemas. The average moviegoer would not encounter these films unless they set out to see them, these shocking horror pictures. So Are the things we see in The Exorcist unprecedented? No. But the fact that so many people were seeing them, that is unprecedented. And that is genuinely revolutionary.
There's a particular scene we referred to, and you were very careful there. Well put, I thought. This is the crucifix scene. I think people will know what we're talking about, have seen the film, of course. Again, the critic Marc Kermode, when he's writing about this particular scene, he said, even years after it was filmed, he said the grotesque impact of it, which he describes as having this repulsive power and just sheer vulgar spectacle, he said remains unparalleled. Now, he wrote this some time ago, but do you think that's right, that his imagery is still remarkable, even talking in 2023?
Yeah, no, I think so. And nothing in my experience of having taught this film suggests otherwise. Yeah. I mean, I've shown this film to older audiences who can remember having seen it in cinemas in the 70s and remember the phenomenon. I've shown it to young people who have no idea about what The Exorcist meant, what its context was. And you can see some of the things that you're talking about. I mean, you can see a close-up of a young girl's hand holding a bloody crucifix aloft as she is about to stab it downwards towards a part of her anatomy that have lost none of their horrifying power.
Andrew Nelson, he's an associate professor of film at the University of Utah. We're going to be screening The Exorcist on October 21st at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Ask about now. This is a spoiler alert. Obviously, all of this has been to date, so there's nothing new here. But I want to ask about the end,
please.
Father Karras calling on the demon to, as he says, "Come into me, take me." Was this the original ending? What do you make of this as an end? Because it sort of gets back at something you had said before, which is that, for as transgressive as The Exorcist seemed, or maybe was for a lot of people, the imagery, obviously the effects, the profanity, those kinds of things, that in the end it was a reaffirmation of some traditional value here, that good did triumph over evil. So what do you – talk a little bit about the ending here and what you make of it.
Yeah. I mean it is – a thoroughly Christian ending. It's about a religious man who takes on the evil and sins of the innocent and then sacrifices himself so that we can all live. I mean, that's the archetypal Christian narrative. So that's what happens. And it's also in terms of the film's story, it's a moment where Karras clearly regains his faith, right? He has the faith necessary. He believes in the demon as a demon, not as some kind of manifestation of psychology with a scientific explanation.
Yeah.
I mean, he gives himself over. He is convinced that the devil is real, kind of in the cliched sense that if the devil is real, then God has to be real too, even if Karras is struggling with the types of questions that I think all believers struggle with. So he undergoes his crisis of faith is resolved. And in the film's conclusion, he conducts the ultimate act of Christian sacrifice. He commands the demon to enter him, and still, probably because of his faith, is able to exercise a modicum of control over his own body and throw himself out the window.
What did people make of all of this
in
1973? Like, what was we talked a little bit about sort of the reaction from some religious people.
Yeah.
But what did the country make of this movie when it came out?
So this was a blockbuster in every sense of the word. I mean, we can quantify that in different ways. It was the third highest grossing film of the 70s after Jaws and Star Wars.
Wow.
It's the ninth highest grossing film of all time when we adjust for inflation. And, you know, if you look at that list, you see it up there with films like, Star Wars and Gone with the Wind. And you ask yourself, what is this terrifying movie doing amongst these historical epics and, you know, family films like E.T.?
Yeah.
Like, it really is a kind of an outlier. So it was just popular in every sense. But what it also was what we might call an affecting film. And this was cleverly, you know, shrewdly capitalized on by Warner Brothers in their promotion of the movie. That there was footage seen in the local news used to promote the film of moviegoers stumbling out of the cinema,
right?
Just literally collapsing to the ground, shaking, cowering. Reports of people, you know, running out of the cinema screaming. Reports of people vomiting, right? All of which is perfect grist for the marketing mill. So it was a genuine cultural phenomena that seemed to affect people in a physical way, which, you know, ties into the idea of the movie that, you know, evil is actually there. It's a real physical thing that is going to affect us in our material plane. And here you have, you know, moviegoers, you know, cowering in the corners of cinemas being attended to by paramedics. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it any better.
Well, and weren't there these rumors that Linda Blair had suffered from mental health issues,
yes,
and that there was this curse that crew members were afflicted?
Injured.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yes. So all of those stories there, family members of cast members, either dying or being in accidents. Crew members losing, appendages and so on. So everything from, you know, death down to small accidents. There was a lot of cursed films in Hollywood history. The Utah classic, The Conqueror with John Wayne, famously filmed downwind from nuclear test sites is one.
Yeah.
And usually when we look at it closely, it actually doesn't bear it out. But this is something that, you know, Friedkin, who's a very shrewd guy, you know, would mention that these disturbing things were happening. So maybe Billy Graham was right. Maybe the devil was in every frame of that film.
Is it a good film? And I don't just mean in the, you know, with the caveat that it's a horror film. Is it a good horror film? No. Is it a good movie?
Oh, yeah. It's not just a good film. It's a great film. I mean, it is the performances from a cast of mostly unknowns at that particular time are professional, you know, incredibly engaging. I mean, the characters are well developed, that even minor characters have the type of arc that an actor needs to give a good performance. Its special effects are state of the art, but there's also a recognition that we could only take things so far, otherwise we would, you know, shatter the illusion of verisimilitude that we're trying to weave here. I mean, it's atmospheric, it's moody. It raises many questions, which I think, you know, good movies do. I think you leave the cinema even today asking yourself questions. It's restrained, especially in its initial version, by not providing us with all of the answers, which I think –
You prefer the initial version.
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
I mean, like the later version is just more explicit. And in some ways, it's reflective of trends in horror filmmaking. So it didn't surprise me in 2001 to not only see the spider walk with new effects – which is significant because it takes Reagan, the possessed Reagan, out of the room, which I think alters the film in some ways. You know, we have the conversation on the staircase, but Friedkin also uses, you know, digital technology to superimpose faces in different places of the movie. So I find that less effective because it's so much more explicit than the original ones. And I think when done right, a great horror film will leave enough to your imagination that you'll start scaring yourself.
How do different audiences experience it? You mentioned you talk about this film with older people.
Yes.
What about younger people who have seen the Saw series and some extremely graphic portrayals of evil?
Yeah, they certainly have. And I think what students learn when they watch this, it's a similar lesson that they learn when they watch other, you know, great horror films from around this time, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Halloween, is that they're actually not as, you know, let's say, graphic in terms of quantity as you might expect based on their reputations. That the films are actually in some kind of perverse way restrained when it comes to graphic depictions of violence, but they're used judiciously to have a heightened impact. And that's certainly the case in The Exorcist, which is an expertly crafted film that builds from these small conventional horror tropes, sounds, not leaving the house and so on that I mentioned earlier, to some of these just gruesome sights that you've never seen before. But they're only momentary. They last but a few minutes. And then there are these long moments of reprieve where they sit with you as a viewer as they do with the characters in the film who have just experienced them. So that's my sense of how my students have responded to it. They love this film very much. And I think it shows them an example of just great filmmaking, of how you can achieve these great effects judiciously. You don't have to hit the audience over the head repeatedly with gore. That if you really want it to be impactful in certain narrative contexts, that you can deploy it selectively and again, let the audience do most of the work of scaring themselves.
Is The Exorcist the scariest movie of all time?
Yeah.
Which is such a crazy subjective question, but it's got to be in the running.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, fear is a highly subjective criterion to use to evaluate films. I mean, so we can talk about, what makes a good film or what makes a great film. And we can, we could point to more concrete criterion. Maybe that will ultimately be a matter of taste, but still there might be something closer to an objective analysis. But what scares you is highly variable. And of course, what scares us changes over time. And yet there does seem to be, over the long history of horror narratives, something like a kind of a universal. There do seem to be these universal monsters, these archetypes that recur. And certainly questions of damnation, what happens to our soul, the idea of evil impinging upon the mortal plane, corrupting innocence. I mean, these are things that we have been dealing with for a long time. They're not just specific to 1973. There are issues we're still dealing with to this day. So, is it the scariest? I mean, have I had students who've told me it wasn't scary? Yes, of course. I've had senior citizens tell me they weren't that scared. They thought it would be scarier. And, and good to them. They're clearly braver people than I.
Yeah.
But, when it comes to films that have the claim of being the scariest, I mean, this one would have to be near the top. I mean, if anything, it certainly scared more people than probably any other film in history.
Andrew Nelson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Andrew Nelson, he's chair of the Film and Media Arts Department at the University of Utah, author of the book Still in the Saddle. You can join us for a screening of The Exorcist on October 21st at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll have a link to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. If you have suggestions or ideas, email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Elle Cowley, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.